On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson. In for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Every now and then, a book comes along that you just can't put down, not even on a hot summer's day with the ocean beckoning. In 2002, the hot summer read was Stephen Carter's debut novel, The Emperor of Ocean Park, a page-turner that combines suspense, murder, and serious talk about race relations. This summer, he's out with a scorching new book, New England White. Joining me now from New York, Stephen Carter, Yale law professor by day, best-selling novelist by night and weekend. His debut novel, The Emperor of Ocean Park, hit number one on the New York Times bestseller list. His new novel is New England White, and it's getting rave reviews. Welcome to you, Stephen Carter.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
So nice to have you with us. Were you at all nervous about writing a second thriller after your first was such a huge hit?
I was nervous about writing the first one. The second one, probably a little bit more so. The first one, I had the advantage. I was writing, you might say, in the darkness, which is just the way to write a thriller, I guess, because only my wife and my kids and my literary agent knew I was even writing one. The second one, everybody knew. I would get letters and emails almost every day saying, where's the next novel? Where's the next novel? So that created a different level of anxiety.
In New England White, you bring back two of the minor characters from The Emperor of Ocean Park. Can you give us just a brief description of the story itself?
Sure. Lemaster and Julia Carlyle, the married couple at the center of the new novel, were minor characters in the first one. They're an African-American couple living in a white, mostly white New England town. Lemaster is the newly appointed president of the unnamed university. His wife is a dean at the Divinity School. One night they're driving home from an event on campus. They discover a body, which turns out to be the body of someone that Julia, the wife, especially knew very well. Lemaster is a man of great power and influence. One of his college roommates is now president of the United States. Another one is a powerful senator planning to run for president. He has a good friend who runs a hedge fund and so on and so on. The short of it is, though, that there was this murder and there was another murder 30 years earlier in the same little town, and the possibility of a connection between those two murders and possibly to the forthcoming presidential election is what draws Julia into her investigation and what gives the dramatic tension to the book.
And Julia really is at the center of this novel. Why did you decide to write a female character as your lead protagonist, and how challenging was that?
It was very challenging, although my first novel, it wasn't easy. My first novel had a first-person narrator, and I think a lot of people assumed that must be me, that must be easy. But that was a hard voice to invent. Julia's was a very hard voice to invent, but I didn't set out to have a female protagonist. This novel originally was going to be told from several different points of view. It just as I was writing it, more than outlining it, as I was writing it, more and more of the story seemed to flow sensibly through her until I just threw up my hands and said, well, let's just make her the major, the major character. And she was fun to write.
She was fun to write. Do you in some ways identify with her? I was reading in your bio, you're born in Washington, D.C., you grew up in New York State, your father was a professor, you come from a distinguished family. In some ways, on some level, do you identify with Julia?
I hadn't considered that possibility, but I suppose it could be, certainly. I think, though, the reason that I really have found her fun to write, I found her an engaging and entirely sensible character, that she's the one who keeps her head when all about her are losing theirs. And that's a characteristic I've always admired. And also that she is a believer in the power of passion sometimes in a versus her husband, who's a great believer in reason. And I think sometimes we need a little passion, a temporary reason.
You have returned to the university town of Elm Harbor in New England White. And as you mentioned, right off the bat, this dead body launches the intrigue. I wonder if you would read a piece from the book.
I'd be happy to. Let me read from the very beginning of chapter one. The one thing I have to tell readers that they would have already learned in a prologue to make sense of this, the Carlyles live in a suburb of New England White called Tyler's Landing, or The Landing for short. So let me read from chapter one, just the very beginning. On Friday, the cat disappeared. The White House phoned, and Jeannie's fever, said the sitter when Julia called from the echoing marble lobby of Lombard Hall, where she and her husband were feting shadowy alumni, one or two facing indictment whose only virtue was piles of money. Jeannie's fever hit 103. After that, things got worse or faster, as her grandmother used to say, although Granny V's Harlem locutions shaped to the rhythm of an era when the race possessed a stylish sense of humor about itself would not have gone over well in The Landing, and Julia Carlyle had long schooled herself to avoid them. The cat was the smallest problem, even if later it turned out to be a portent. Rainbow Coalition, the children's smelly feline mutt, had vanished before and usually came back, but now and then stayed away and was dutifully replaced by another dreadful creature of the same name. The White House was another matter. LeMaster's college roommate, now residing in the Oval Office, telephoned at least once a month, usually to shoot the breeze, a thing that had never before occurred to Julia that presidents of the United States did. As to Jeannie, while the child was a solid 8 years into a feverish childhood, the youngest of four, and her mother knew by now not to rush home at each spike of the thermometer. Tylenol and cool compresses had so far defeated every virus that had dared attack her child and would stymie this one, too. Julia gave the sitter her marching orders and returned to the endless dinner in time for LeMaster's closing jokes. It was 11 minutes before 10 on the second Friday in November in the year of our Lord, 2003. Outside Lombard Hall, the snow had arrived early, 2 inches on the ground and more expected. As the police later would reconstruct the night's events, Professor Kellen Zant was already dead and on the way to town in his car.
Mm-hmm. There's a Murder, She Wrote quality to this book. It seems everybody, without giving anything away, everyone appears to have a motive. Everyone.
Well, you know, I have a view that campuses, like small towns, are wonderful places to set mysteries and thrillers. I think a campus is an inherently scary place. Now, we don't think of it that way, but you have all these towers, especially if they're Gothic towers, and at night they're dark and empty. Maybe there's light burning here and there. People at night are rushing across campus. They have someplace to go. No one's lingering there. It's this vast, empty space with these huge rabbit warren buildings. I just feel they're inherently scary and mysterious places, so naturally I would have to people a campus in a college town with scary and mysterious characters.
New England White is, it's a very evocative title. It conjures up all sorts of images. There's Gothic tower in the front of the book itself. Is it just me, or does there seem to be a lot of snowstorms in this novel?
There is a lot of snow in the novel, maybe more snow than you would reasonably have. People tell me, oh, come on, it doesn't snow much in New England in November, which is when the novel begins. But this year, the year of the novel, evidently it did. I just think the title itself, it does give us images on so many different levels, and some of them are easy to see. You can think of the whiteness of the snow. Some people associate with, say, the whiteness of New England college towns. But there's something else also. I'm always interested in what lies beneath. I'm interested in secrets. And we use, for better or worse, in America, commonly the metaphor of whiteness as purity, pure as the driven snow and so on. I'm interested in what lies below that blanket of purity that may lay over a seemingly perfect family, a seemingly placid campus, a seemingly calm and happy New England town. I'm interested in what lies beneath all of that surface whiteness.
When you wrote your first novel, did you already plan on using Julia and her husband in a future book?
Julia and LeMaster were one of several sets of characters I thought of exploring. There are some others as well. I think I'll probably do some more novels, if the Lord spares me to keep writing, with some other characters from the Ambrosian Park. It just happens that LeMaster and Julia happened to be the characters whose story became most polished fastest. I have some other less polished versions of stories involving some of the other characters from that novel.
Would you describe this Stephen Carter, this book, as a mystery or a thriller? And to your mind, what's the difference between the two?
You know, actually, I'd probably describe it first as a family saga. It's a story about a family. It's a story about generations of a family. It's a story about love and the varieties of love within a family. It is also a mystery because in a mystery, in the end, we're trying to think of who done it. There's a crime. We want to know who committed the crime. But it's also a thriller in the sense that it enmeshes the family in a situation beyond its control, which is crucial in the thrill. There has to be something beyond the control of the protagonist that pulls the family on twists and turns they themselves don't expect to take. So it's something of a hybrid of the two, I suppose.
And why this genre? Why this kind of a book?
A lot of people point out that lawyers and some law professors, when they're drawn to fiction, are often drawn to mysteries and thrillers. And I think I know why. Because what do we all hate about lawyers? We hate that when you go to a lawyer and you sit down to do something simple, say, write your will, the first thing the lawyer says is, have you thought about this? Have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? Have you thought about that? That's how we train lawyers, we law professors. From the first day of law school, there's always a hypothetical. There's always a contingency. There's always another question. Isn't that what a thriller is, really? What if this happened? What if this happened? What if this happened? It's taking the possibilities that other people wouldn't think of for what could happen next and making them real, which is the same thing we do in the law school classroom. Mm-hmm.
We're talking with novelist and Yale Law School professor Stephen Carter about his new novel, New England White. It's climbing the charts of the New York Times bestsellers list as we speak. Stephen, a central component of the book and of the plot deals with these former college roommates and the run for the presidency, and they both have secret ties to this 30-year-old murder, and then another murder that threatens to shatter not only the Carlyles' marriage, your central characters, but also this fragile psyche of their daughter, Vanessa. I wonder if that setup, if you'd read a second piece from your book.
That would be my my pleasure. After the Carlyles find the body of this prominent economist named Kellen Zant, who's been shot, the detectives come and interview them at their house, and it's a long interview, but I'm just going to read a few paragraphs at the very end of that interview, both what it tells us about Julia Carlyle and a little bit of what it tells us about her relationship with her husband. So this is the end of that interview. A signal passed between the detectives. Oh, yes, we almost forgot. One more thing. Would you, Mrs. Carlyle, be able to characterize for us your relationship with the decedent? Relationship? Weren't you once close and personal friends? A speechless moment, only the detectives able to make eye contact with anybody else in the room. History piled up behind her, thick and strong. She recalled a face of quite seductive jolliness, a sparkling delight focused on her alone. Yes, we were, briefly, but that was before my marriage. Can you tell us when you talked to him last? As much as saying they did not believe her. We have a busy day, gentlemen, Lemaster said, and her appreciation of him quickened and felt like love. They sorried and thanked their way out the door.
Julia Carlyle proves to be a rather unlikely but dogged investigator, doesn't she?
Well, she is indeed. You know, she had this earlier relationship, we now know, with Kellen Zant, the man who's been murdered. It was a very destructive relationship. She married Lemaster not long after the end of that relationship. He's older than she is, 8 years older. She says he sometimes treats her like a child, and she quotes her grandmother, who said that the danger is if you marry a man because you want him to take care of you, you run the risk that he will, said her grandmother. Mm-hmm. And she feels almost too well taken care of. She's cocooned in Lemaster's perfect world. And so a part of her is investigating because it's a mystery involving her ex-lover. A part of her is investigating because her troubled daughter may be involved in it somehow. But I think a part of her is also investigating because she wants to break loose from this constant shell of protection her husband has dropped around her, where she never has any risks, never faces any dangers, where everything in her life is taken care of. She wants to escape that. Mm.
Tell us what your writing process is like, Stephen Carter. How do you go about this work?
I've often been told that writers are the worst people to describe their own writing processes, but let me try. When I write a novel, and I've finished these two, and I have another one that should be out next summer, I always start with the characters. That is, I know who I want to write about before I know the story that I want to tell about them. From there, I usually figure out from the characters where I want them to start and where I want them to finish, what the beginning and the end are. And I often write the very beginning and very end of my novel and then write the outline. Hmm. So in New England White, for example, I had the prologue and the epilogue, and then I wrote an outline of a novel connecting the two to try to place these characters in it. It's character-driven fiction in a sense, and yet plot is very important to me. I love the twists and turns of a thriller. The other thing I should say about my writing process is because I'm also a full-time law professor, of course, I have to find time to write that lets me do my other work. And so I'm often writing my fiction late at night or on weekends because I don't want to take away from the other work I do as a law professor.
So much about writing is about pacing and tension, especially in a thriller, and getting the balance right. You know, what is your gauge, Stephen? How do you know that you've got the reader hooked?
Well, my wife tells me. My wife, who's also trained as a lawyer, who does not read fiction, but she reads mine, and she reads everything in early drafts long before my editor sees it. My wife sees it and tells me if the pacing is working or not. And it's good that she does that because otherwise I think I would write everything into the ground. I get so obsessed when I'm writing fiction that I'm just constantly picking and changing things. So my wife insists it's time for me to read it. She says she looks at it. Mm-hmm. She tells me if it's any good, and she'll tell me if it's not. Tells me when it has to be changed, and I go back and try to do pretty much what she says. She keeps me from a lot of really bad choices.
Mm-hmm. I read about you that you've always love to write, that as a little boy, you'd buy spiral notebooks at the corner store and write little novels in them. Is this true?
Oh, you heard that story. Yeah, it's true. When I was 8 or 9 years old, living in Washington, D.C., I used to walk down to the store on the corner. Actually, it was a store in the basement of an apartment building on the corner. I'd go down to the store, and I'd buy my baseball cards. My allowance was a quarter. I'd buy my baseball cards for a nickel, and the other 20 cents I'd spend on one of these little notebooks. And I would write stories in them. And my stories were, you know, dinosaurs take over the world and they're defeated by a plucky little boy. Aliens take over the world, they're defeated by a plucky little boy. That kind of thing. The point is, I was writing stories. I've always loved putting words together on the page. It's the only thing that I do, the only skill I have that I think I'm better than most people at is putting words together. Hmm. And I so love doing it.
Hmm. Interesting. Our first caller is Mark from Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Mark, hello. You're on the air with Stephen Carter.
Hi, Jane. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Good. I wanted to call in because I picked up the book a few weeks ago, and I'm in the middle of reading it. I'm near the end. I'm up to chapter 53. And I just wanted to say it's one of those reads where I'm trying to hold off reading the end because I've enjoyed the book so much, and it's just caught my attention. I put aside things I should be doing to read the book, and to me, that's always a good read. If it's captured my attention and imagination so much, it's so well written, and I just want to thank the author for a wonderful book.
Ah,
well, thank you, Mark. That's praise every author likes to hear. I'm glad you're enjoying it that much, but I do hope you get back to your other work.
Indeed, Mark. Thank you for your call. How do you know when it should end?
It's a hard thing to do. It's not hard to figure out how to end the book. It's hard for me to stop playing with the book, to stop wanting to improve it all the time. And the discipline I'm learning is to stop messing around with it, let my wife read it, let my editor read it, and then go back and mess around with it some more. I really do need, I'm not a writer who works entirely on my own. I do need the intervention of other people to help me see how it's going and when I ought to cut it out.
Mm. New England White, in many ways, I guess it's a ghost story, you know, with characters haunted by their past, right? And the Carlyle's daughter, Vanessa, believing that this ghost of a murdered young woman from 30 years ago is actually speaking to her, right? Why did you want to explore this idea of sort of being haunted?
Well, yeah, you're right. It's not a ghost story in the formal sense. It's not a horror novel, but there is the sense in which all of us are haunted by our pasts in certain ways, I think. And I think most people who are very prominent in any field of life have things in their pasts which may have been very minor, but which over the years have taken on enormous importance for them. The one thing they hope nobody will ever find out they did or were involved in, at whatever age it might be. I think that most of us have those fears, and I think prominent people probably have them even greater. And that's something I think haunts people through their public lives a lot. And I thought to myself, why not then explore those things that might haunt people's pasts, especially on a Gothic college campus?
Would you tell us what haunts you?
You know, We're all haunted by mistakes we've made over the years, I suppose, and without going into details about them, I've certainly made my share. Let me just let me just leave it at that.
Your portrait of marriage in the book, Stephen Carter, New England White, is fraught with challenges and resentments and daily negotiations, if you will. It's very realistic. And you looked at the complexities of family life, as you also did in Emperor, right?
You know, one of the reasons I wanted to explore marriage exactly that way is that when the Carlyles show up briefly in The Emperor of Ocean Park, and it is a very brief appearance, Misha Garland, the narrator of that novel, looks at them and thinks their marriage is perfect. He uses that word perfect to describe the children, to describe Julia, to describe Lemaster, and to describe the marriage. And I think we all of us probably know people in marriages or other relationships who seem perfect together to us on the outside. And yet we sometimes must wonder, what are the strains that really beset that relationship? And so I was trying to set up the marriage in a way that it could continue to look perfect on the outside. And the kind of strains they have, it's not that Julia's husband is cheating on her or using drugs or beating her or something. He's just a kind of man who looks perfect from the outside. But when you live with him, live with a man for whom life is all about reason and not about passion. It's all about tradition and not about anything new. To live with a man like that, as perfect as he may seem to her friends and to others, ends up being very, very difficult. And I wanted to get across that notion that the marriage that looks perfect on the outside can be terribly difficult for the people in it, even when nothing is going wrong in the usual sense of marital disasters.
Mm. Pam is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Pam, hello to you. You're on the line.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I read The Emperor last summer, and I now have your new book on my bedside yet to be cracked, and I'm sure it's going to be great. My question is, both of these books are about the same family and the same upper-class milieu. Did you ever envision yourself writing outside that, you know, that set?
Thanks, Pam.
That's a great question, and it's perfectly reasonable. And the answer is yes, I do. In fact, when I think of my several unfinished novels, I'll give you two examples. One of the characters from The Emperor of Ocean Park, who I think deserves his own novel, is Mark Hadley. Mark Hadley is a white male. He's not black, upper crust, or anything like that. And yet I found him an interesting enough character that I really want to write a novel told from his point of view, to take just one example. My novel that's coming out next year, which has a number of different characters in it, it's mainly people, black and white, who are not from the upper crust. It's a different set of people, you might say. So I think it's a reasonable question, given the families at the heart of these first two novels, but it really is something that I've explored. I'm interested in exploring other things now.
Do you have a favorite character in the book?
I do. I have two. One of my favorite minor character is Trevor Land, who works for the university in a vaguely defined role, who's really the secret, semi-secret backdoor conduit for wealthy alumni who want to get in touch with the university. I've always had the sense that universities have to have someone like him. If you're going to rely on your alumni to give you tens and tens of millions of dollars year after year, there has to be some way they can get in touch other than just calling the phone and going to the switchboard and asking for somebody's assistant. So I like that idea of backstage power. I said I like to look at what lies beneath the obvious, and so he plays that role. But I also like Julia Carlyle, the protagonist. Mm. I never liked Misha Garland that much, the protagonist of my first novel. Mm. I wrote his voice. It was interesting to write, but I never really enjoyed writing it. Julia was a joy to write. I find her a refreshing, fascinating character.
I have heard you say that there was a time when the campus novel was a fairly common part of American fiction, and not so much anymore. Is that your take?
I think that's right. There are still some people. There are practitioners of the campus novel. Jane Smiley, for example, comes to mind. But really, we don't get as much of the campus novel set on campuses as we did, say, 40 or 50 years ago. I'm not entirely sure why that is, but I'd be happy if we saw more of it.
Hmm. In the author's note, in the back of the book, Stephen Carter, you assure your readers that the site of this novel is, quote, not thinly disguised New Haven.
Yeah.
I guess we're to presume that the unnamed university is not Yale, where you currently reside.
That's right. I do say in that author's note that the two of them share a lot of the same ghosts. And people are always saying to me, oh, come on, we all know it's Yale. Oh, come on, we all know it's New Haven. But what they really mean is that they know that New Haven is the town I know best. They know that Yale is the campus I know best. And that, of course, is true. The reason I say they share some of the same ghosts is it would be astonishing if some of the details of the life I know best didn't leak into it. But it's mainly invented. It's an invented campus, an invented town, which has the advantage that I can have pretty much anything happen to pretty much anybody or any building or any town without having to worry about upsetting any actual people or actual buildings or actual towns.
Hmm. Bernadette is on the line from Hopton, Massachusetts, actually. Bernadette, hello to you.
Hello. How's it going?
Fine, thank you. What's your question?
I want to know, would I have to read the first novel in order to really enjoy the second novel? Like, will I understand the characters in the second novel? Julia, for example, if they were written and developed in the first novel?
Good question, Bernadette. Thank you.
That's a great question, and I appreciate it, but you certainly shouldn't feel that you have to read the first novel to understand or get anything out of the second one. They're written as independent novels. They happen to have some of the same characters, but it's not a sequel in any sense. It's not saying, here's what happened next. So there's nothing in the Emperor of Ocean Park you need to know, I hope, to enjoy Lingold White, and vice versa. So please read them in any order that that you like.
How long did it take you to write this?
Years. It's a little misleading because, unlike a lot of writers of fiction, I can't write all the time because I have another full-time job as a law professor. But it took me several years, in the course of which I also worked on several other novels. That I wasn't really sure which of the several novels I was working on would wind up being the one I would publish first. It was a matter of which one would first seem the most polished. That was a matter of a consultation with my wife and with my editors, but also ultimately my own instinct about which novel I really felt was going to be ready. This one I'm trying to learn now is working on only one novel at a time instead of writing two or three at the same time. Mm. And that's why I have another one coming out next year.
Stephen, I want to read a couple of reviews of your book before I pose a question.
Uh-oh. You know, I don't read the reviews of my books.
You
so
don't?
No. I'm very scrupulous. I don't read them. I don't like to hear what's in them. When I first started writing, I used to read all the reviews, and I would even write letters to the editor or even to the reviewer if I didn't like the review. But I stopped reading the reviews about 6 or 7 years ago, and I'm happier for it.
Huh. Well, this one comes from the Los Angeles Times. First off, I don't think you'll be disappointed. They called your first novel, The Emperor of Ocean Park, quote, a rare look into the world of wealth and established black families. One is at a loss to name another book that has sought to convey with such clarity, such depth of understanding, or such cultural analysis, the uniqueness of this experience. And then Publishers Weekly reviewed New England White, your newest novel, and called it, quote, a compelling page-turner that effortlessly blends a gripping whodunit with complex discussions of politics and race in contemporary America, end quote. So what's the message that you're trying to convey in your writing?
I think that to call it a message may be too strong. I really mean first and foremost to entertain. I can't make that clear enough. But at the same time, it is true, as those excerpts suggest and as one of the callers suggested, in these first two novels, I certainly have talked a lot about well-to-do African-Americans. But, you know, it's a class of people that fascinates me in the following sense. If you think about America, if you think about 200 years of slavery and 100 years of Jim Crow and many kinds of discrimination persisting after that, the notion that there were families that through all that managed for one generation after another to maintain a business, to be educated, to maintain a profession is to me a fascinating story of triumph against remarkable odds. There's 7 generations. And people have said to me, how is that possible? But part of the answer is there were, in fact, very successful black architects in the United States, in Boston, for example, and on Cape Cod, at the time of the Revolutionary War. So it's rare, it's unusual, But it's not unheard of. And I think that one of the reasons I've discussed, let us say, this class of people in the book is as a kind of celebration of remarkable attainment.
Hmm. We lost your audio for there for just a moment. So if I ask you a question that you're repeating your answer, I'm sorry. But in New England White, you describe the club life of the black community and the enormous hold that it had on much of the social life of the middle class society in America. Describe that history for us, if you would.
It is quite interesting that even today, the club life, the social organizations, the men's and women's groups, the fraternities and sororities in the African-American community maintain an importance that they've largely lost in the larger community in America. A lot of these groups were founded just about 100 years ago as a black middle class began to emerge in America and a black educated class began to emerge, especially in the North, but found that the various clubs and other what we now think of as networking sites that existed for the larger community were closed to them. So a lot of these groups began around that time, some of them on college campuses, some of them in big cities. What's remarkable about these groups, about these clubs, is they've persisted and continue to hold enormous influence. If you look at the, say, black people who are prominent heading large corporations in America, or someone like Oprah Winfrey, say, you'll discover that almost without exception, there are some exceptions, but almost without exception, they are members of one or more of these fraternities, sororities, and other sorts of clubs. So that even today, they maintain an importance in American life that maybe in the larger community clubs no longer have.
Hmm. Will blacks and whites read this book differently?
That's a fair question to which I don't know entirely the answer. That is, to the extent that it's thriller and a mystery, I hope people enjoy it the same way. But I think that here's one thing I've found. It is true. A lot of black readers of both this book and the previous novel will come to me at, say, a book signing and say, yes, I identified with that story you told. Like there's a story in New England White about Julia Carlisle, who lives in this small town, being turned away from the town beach because they don't believe she's a resident. And black readers will sometimes come to me and say, yes, I identify with that story. And sometimes white readers will come to me and say, in all innocence, would that really happen? Do you really believe something like that could happen? That sort of thing. So there are those differences. And in that sense, if the book, in addition to being a novel that I hope people will enjoy, plays a role in tweaking people's attention in certain directions, then I suppose I'd have to count that as a success.
Tweaking people's attention in a different direction. Race really, it's key to the plot in New England, White.
It is in a way, although, people keep saying that, and maybe it's true, and maybe I'm not reading the book with the care that I, as the author, really should. But the reason I think race seems to be key to the plot in certain ways is because the characters themselves are black people who've existed and lived in a way in a world where there are hidden racial tensions, as there often are. So the racial tensions do indeed play a role in the story, and yet it's not ultimately, I think, a novel about race. I hope it's a novel ultimately about people.
Hmm. How do you see the place of African Americans in our society today?
Well, there's really we're moving toward two African Americas, and that's a very serious problem in America. That is to say, that we're moving rapidly in America toward a group of well-off, usually married, employed, educated black Americans. That's one group. And a large group being left behind by blacks and whites alike being left behind. Mm. A large group of black people in the inner city and in rural poverty, not as well educated, not well taken care of, a group without jobs, often without health care, without good educational possibilities. We really are moving toward that, those two separate groups. And it really scares me a lot to see all these black people being left behind. And I worry that more and more black people in American politics are not so much important in the debate the way that race was central 40 years ago, say, that our debates. They're more prompts for ideological positions on the left and the right. It's almost as though we do our ideological experiments through the black community depending on who's in power. But it's not a central issue. Everybody always says, well, there's more important stuff we've got to take care of first, and then we'll get to race and poverty.
You talk about how the stature or status of African Americans in this country scares you. How do you bridge the divide then, in your mind?
Well, I don't know all of the answers, but I do think that it's important to stop being partisan about the problem of race in America. That is, what happens if you get people together to talk about race? If there are people on the left, they know all the Republican Party's ideas are bad. And if they're on the right, they know all Democratic Party ideas are bad. And it's possible that there are good ideas on both sides. I think that we can need to try to be both and people, one from column A, one from column B people, instead of all from column A and none from column B. I think that's a start. But that's true of so many of our problems, I think, that we view them through such a hard ideological lens that we tend to think if somebody from the other camp, whatever camp that may be, comes up with an idea, it's got to be a bad one. Let's stick to air camps. Ideas. That's a dangerous trend in politics anywhere, because that's a trend that makes us talk only to ourselves and people who think like us, and to view those who disagree with us not as fellow citizens who we love as God's children, but rather as the enemy.
Are you pleased with the political representatives out there today from the African American community, the Barack Obamas and others?
Well, you know, I don't pretend to follow, let us say, electoral politics as regularly and rigorously as some do. But as a scholar, I can say this, that the data about the voting patterns of representatives who happen to be black suggest that on most issues, there's no particular black point of view that representatives vote pretty much with their party. And there's very strong data on this going back many, many years. It shouldn't be surprising. In other words, the voting patterns of black and white representatives in Congress, say, black and white Democrats, is not different. They have very similar voting patterns on just about every issue. So it's not a matter for me as a scholar being pleased or displeased. It's simply that the racial identity of the representative is, in the end, less important than what policies the person pursues.
Hmm. Back to the phones for a moment. Wayne is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Wayne, you're on the air with Professor Stephen Carter.
Hello.
Hello.
My question for Mr. Carter is, what does he think is the unique value that the novel offers modern life? Or what power does the novelist have that is unique?
Good question, Wayne. Thank you.
Not only is it a great question, I'm actually writing a book about books. I'm writing a book, a nonfiction book, about why books are important, why books matter, not why reading matters, why books matter. And that's a long story. Let me give you two quick short answers, one
sure.
About the novel and about books generally. The point about books generally is that books represent the idea of permanence, the idea that an idea can be sufficiently worthwhile that it's worth setting it out in a medium of expression that you can't take down like you can take down a web page. You can be stuck with it on the library shelf for all time. But more than that, the thing about the novel is a novel, of course, should entertain us. It should be interesting. It might introduce us to things that are new. But there's something else a novel does. A novel invites our entire brain into the conversation, not just the part of us that engages with arguments and ideas, but the other parts of our brain as well are invited into the same conversation. And that the creative thing the novelist does is to take both halves of the brain and put them together. And the creative thing that does for the reader is to allow the reader to use both halves of the brain at the same time, which might wind up with us focusing on problems and ideas in new and exciting ways.
Who are your favorite novelists? What do you read when you're not reading your own?
When I talk about favorite novelists, I only talk about novelists who are no longer with us, because I found that when I talk about novelists who are still writing, I always get these emails, and it's always, how could you like him, or how could you mention him in the same breath with her, or something like that. So let me tell you a couple novels from the past whose work I really admire and why. They're very different. I'll just mention two. Charles Dickens and James Baldwin. They may seem very different, but let me tell you why I like them. I've always loved Charles Dickens because of the sheer delight he took in characterization. You could tell reading his novels that he had more fun with his characters than he ever did with his plots. He loved his characters. He had affection for them. He took joy in how he described them. And I feel a similar joy in my characters. I mentioned James Baldwin for a different reason. The thing about Baldwin is his novels were always very short, and yet you were exhausted when you finished because emotion crackled from every page. You were constantly in the grind, the pain, the pleasures, the delight, the fears of people's lives from page 1 to page 200 or however long the novel might have been. He dragged you through their psyches in a way that was powerful and exciting. And the reason that's important is that I really think that a lot of human life is the constant battle between emotion and desire, what we want or need, and reason and morality, what we think we should want or need. And Baldwin did a wonderful job of illustrating the way that passion overcomes constantly, no matter how we struggle, passion overcomes often our will and whatever is our stated desire of what it is we want to do. And I really think that that battle is at the heart of the human psyche.
Hmm. And that battle, the battle between emotion and desire, how is that played out, or how did you want to play that out in your book, New England White?
I may have done it oversimply in a way, because in placing this family at the heart of this mystery where they're constantly pushed from one thing to the next, I had Julia representing the idea of feeling your way through the problem, and Lemaster, you're representing the way of thinking your way through the problem. And of course, part of the point is that in the end, neither one is entirely adequate. You can't solve the whole mystery and successfully save your family just by reasoning, Lemaster's way. And you can't solve the whole mystery and save your family just by feeling, which is initially Julia's way. It's when Julia moves more toward a mix of the two that she's able to solve the mystery and triumph.
Hmm. Back to the phones. Masha is calling from Dorchester, Massachusetts. Hello, you're on the line.
Hello. This is a thrill. I read Emperor of Ocean Park, and I really loved it. And my question is, Professor Carter, did you self-consciously hearken back to the 19th century, the great 19th century Russian novelists in writing that? Hmm. Because I thought that, reading it, my guess was that you had everything from Misha Garland's nickname to there was a small reference to the Department of Slavic Languages, the reference to semiotics. Mm-hmm. I really thought that you were kind of pointing us to think of your novel in that context, and I was wondering if I was right, if that was really your intention.
Thank you, Masha.
That's a great question. I wouldn't say it was consciously true. When I was younger, I used to read a lot of 19th century Russian literature, however. I really enjoyed it. I don't think I've picked up a Russian novel probably in 10 or 15 years, in all honesty, from that era. But I used to read a lot of them, and so I'd be very surprised if there were no influences in my work.
In both Emperor and in this new novel, New England White, Stephen Carter, it seems that the idea of legacy is very important to you. Is that accurate, and why?
It is accurate, and I think it's because, and their forebears, the notion of being in a tradition and growing the tradition and handing it on was important to my family when I was growing up. It's important to my wife and myself now. I don't pretend that this is necessarily the way everyone needs to live their lives. But for me, as a young black man being raised in a family that had a tradition of being educated, for example, my grandmother was a lawyer in New York City. She was the first black woman prosecutor in New York. Hmm. We were really raised to the idea that we owed something to those who went before us, that they fought battles and done things, and we couldn't let them down. And that's something we try to pass on as well. I think it's something a lot of African-American families try to pass on. I think a lot of other families do as well. So it is important to me. It is important to us. I wouldn't claim that it's a prescription for every family, but it has been the way that we've tried to raise our children.
What's next? Stephen Carter, you've got another book out next summer?
I have a novel coming out next summer, which is a little different. It has a broader historical sweep, begins in the 1950s and ends in the 1970s. But it's still a mystery and a thriller, I hope. And then after that, I hope to finish that book about books that I mentioned.
Stephen Carter, the new novel is New England White. What a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much.
Jane, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Jane Clayson. In for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.